Applying Cool Tech, October 24, 2005. Hey y'all, how are you? I'm Larry Skutkan, here today with Rob Meredith. And with the risk of beating a dead horse totally into the ground, we wanted to talk a little bit more today about digital recorders and some observations and experiences. And Rob spent the weekend playing with the, experimenting with the M-Audio player. Tell us a little bit about that, Rob.
Well, the M-Audio MicroTrack is an interesting little recorder. In fact, I think this is a great time to be alive if you're interested in compact flash recorders, because this seems to be it. We have finally started to see some serious contenders come out on the market. And I hope it's only going to get better. I don't know for sure. We don't know if there's other companies that have products up their sleeves that just haven't made it out yet. We don't know if M-Audio plans another product or any role. But we do know that it's getting real interesting.
Let me do a check. Okay. One of the problems, though, is we are seeing some really interesting devices, but the more that we're seeing, the more problems we're seeing with accessibility.
Yeah, rather than a whole discussion of the MicroTrack and its technical specifications and performance, which I could easily babble on about for probably 24 hours, we thought today we'd focus on, put the accessibility spin on this whole experience. Because we've seen a lot of recorders of late, and as you all know, the frustration is, you know, you get the thing out of the box, and you're as excited as the guy next to you that has one, but he can use his, and you had to learn how to use yours. And the learning experience may be relatively simple. It may be a several days experience. You may never master all the features if you're not motivated or can't gain access to them because they're designed in such a way that they're just too inconvenient to get to and gamble on getting the wrong one.
One of the things you have to look at, too, is, you know, are we going backwards from the days of the tape recorder?
Right, because cassette recorders, most people finally got that down. They're not too complex. You put the tape in. You press one button if you want to play, two buttons if you want to record. The drill is pretty straightforward on the cassette recorder.
And it helped that they have speakers built into them, so it's easy to do a test recording, check it out. That's not always the case with these digital recorders, though, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I will give Olympus a lot of credit for one of the more accessible designs in fairly... this certainly isn't a professional quality recorder. It's good, though. The DS2 and the WS200 are the ones I've had experience with.
And they have interesting looks. They're small. In the case of the WS200S, it pulls apart, so you can just plug it directly into your USB port, which is really something to see if you haven't.
That is one of the most clever hardware designs I've ever seen. Very nice.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things in particular with that one. Well, let's stick with accessibility. Even accessibility-wise, you know you're recording on that device. I mean, by default, the menus, the buttons all beep. When you go through the menus, you get a beep. It's difficult to set all the options independently unless you've memorized the menus. But it is one of the more accessible recorders. Now, when we talk about the R1 and the M-Audio M-Tracks, those are another story.
Yeah, and I want to say up front that... this is just a healthy discussion. I don't want to encourage or discourage someone from investigating these products further or buying one over the other. But with that said, the R1, to me, is in some ways 1,000 times easier to use than the MicroTrack.
Really?
Yeah, and the reason is the menus don't wrap, and there's no submenus. And if you memorize the menus that you do use, or the items you do use in the main menu, and carefully click the wheel the right amount of times, and you know where your enter and your exit button are, you're good to go. You can get through it. You might make a mistake. It's also, to Eddie Roll's credit, particularly easy to restore defaults, where you just hold down a particular key when you turn a device on. Now, on the micro track, the menus do wrap. There are submenus. And there's no audio cues whatsoever. Of course, there's no audio cues on the R1 either. But there's almost no way to tell what you're about to do or what you have done in the case of the micro track. And while there is a restore factory defaults option, it happens to be on a menu.
One thing I'll say about the Eddie Roll, too, is some of the controls on it are actually analog controls. And there's advantages and disadvantages to that.
I mentioned in my review that I was grateful for the analog control. And I don't know if grateful was the best choice. It has its advantages. But I like the digital controls on the MicroTrack because, you know, in the case of the MicroTrack, for example, that there's essentially 20 ticks between the lowest level, which is still a signal, it's not totally silent, and the highest level. And once you kind of get used to your routine and the kind of things you might record, you can just count those clicks. It would be fairly difficult to mark the analog wheel on the R1. I wouldn't say impossible, but it's small enough and has enough ridges in it, it'd be really difficult to put your own custom markings on that wheel. And, of course, the other technical reason that an analog control isn't as good is because you have essentially two resistors in that control that work together in conjunction, and they're not always going to be totally in sync as a result of the fact that it's a physical device.
Well, and the other disadvantage, like we were talking about the other day, is when you lock the switch to lock the keys, that your analog keys or your analog controls are still not locked.
Right. So at least in the case of the MicroTrack, the lock means lock. There's no analog controls that I can think of on the MicroTrack. Or the R1 has the volume control for playback and the record level control. And let me see. Yeah, those are the two ones that would be changeable.
You know, essentially it looks like we've got two problems here. One, if someone were to make a recorder that was totally accessible, the market would be so small that this recorder would end up costing $1,000.
Right.
The other is that if somehow we could convince some of the people that are already building these things in, you know, the millions quantities to add a few features, I believe they would be good enough that we could use. And yeah. I think you mentioned one of those features is not making those menus wrap, having them, you know, having the menu come up in a predictable place. And I think putting a beep into the, you know, with each key press so that you know that you didn't accidentally hit a key.
Well, I break these into two categories, no cost and low cost. Low cost would be something like a beep. You know, you might have to add a beeper or you might have to have a small tone generation circuit to get a beep out to your headphones or whatever the process might be. You might have to write a little piece of code to play a small wave. That would be what I would call low cost. But in the area of no cost, we can do things like don't wrap menus, or if the sighted public insists that the menus wrap, and I can understand where that might be an advantage in some situations. Another no-cost alternative would be to have hidden keys that do particular things. For example, on a recorder, you might decide that the play key, if held down for 1 second, would go to the top of a menu.
Mm-hmm.
So there's plenty of things. It's not lack of potential user interface devices on these machines. It's the implementation. And a no-cost, low-cost solution. The only cost I could think of in the case of adding, you know, so-called Easter egg features like hold down play to get to the top of a menu would just be the documentation. You have to get a way to get the word out to these people that are using these products. That might be a little tricky. But if people would, A, stop and think a little bit, and B, take action, it seems like these products could become, you know, multiple times more accessible for a, you know, a no-cost, low-cost solution.
Why do you always put Jake to sleep, Rob?
I don't know.
Wake up, Jake. Another thing, this isn't necessarily in the realm of accessibility, but another thing that it seems to me like these recorders need are some limit controls, some way to have an automatic gain control and some limiting. I mean, I'm all in favor of having manual as well, but I think in 90% of the situations that people want to record, just like with the old, you know, APH desktop recorder, you want to go into a classroom, a lecture, you want to hit record and let that thing pick up as good as it can.
Right, and we forgot to mention that the R1 does have a limiter, and the MicroTrack doesn't have a limiter. That is a serious drawback for on-the-road type, you know, field recordings where people want to maybe do a podcast or a sightseeing tour. You're going to get into a situation where a truck's going to go by, or somebody's going to slam a door, or the wind's going to blow, or something's going to happen that's going to make the recording level totally unacceptable and clip badly. And if you try to hedge against that by turning your controls down, you're going to wind up with a really soft signal. And then you're faced with the choice of either doing some kind of software dynamic compression on the PC, or just leaving it like it is and letting people turn up their playback equipment. Now on the R1, the limiter is just that. It doesn't give you any gain compensation. In other words, it doesn't make things seem louder. And it works essentially independent of the analog level control, where you can still turn the level control all the way up and let the limiter take all the hits. You can also pull the level control back if you want to avoid, if you're more of a purist and you want to avoid a limiter, you can pull the control back and just use it as a safety backup kind of a thing.
What about suggestions for accessible ways to set levels when you don't want to use a limiter or automatic gain control?
Well, this is interesting. Both devices use entirely different ways of setting levels. Actually, I have not had anyone describe to me the meter on the MicroTrack, but I know that the R1 uses a system of bars, and they move across horizontally like old meters on a tape deck would. And essentially, the book has a chart that says if you have this many bars, you're this many dB down from full scale, and if you're at the rightmost bar, you've clipped. The MicroTrack does have a meter, but interestingly enough, it also has clip lights.
Hmm.
And it would seem to me like clip lights could be easily rigged up to be accessible somehow. I don't know exactly what the difference between the time the clip light comes on the MicroTrack and the actual clip, but it's not really on a clip. It's probably one or two dB down from a clip. That was one thing I forgot to measure. But certainly, you could use a light probe to pick up those lights, but then you'd pretty much ruin your recording.
Well, what about the idea of a beep for an audible?
A nice little audible beep in the corresponding channel to go along with a clip light would be excellent in the case of the MicroTrack, and it seems like it would be easily done. That would probably be a low cost because you would need to generate that tone and get it out to the headphones into the monitor mix somehow. But I'm sure the clever people at these companies, if motivated properly, could certainly get that done.
I guess that's the real question. How do we get these people interested in this?
Right.
You know, there's a conference going on next month, the Portable Media Expo, that's all about this. Well, not about accessibility, but about players and recorders. It would sure be good to have some accessibility advocacy going on there. I know Daryl Shandro has been talking on his podcast, the Blind Access Journal, about going over there. I think his main beef right now, one of his main problems is this whole visual verification, which isn't so much to do with portable media, but I know he's had a lot of frustration with the iRiver, as have I and others. You know, I guess if you want to put a new battery in it every time you go to start recording, there's about a 95% chance that you're always going to get a recording, but you just never know.
Yeah, that I forgot that. That the battery meter on these devices is, of course, another totally inaccessible aspect that serious users making once-in-a-lifetime recordings need to know about. And I don't record much. I'm more interested in the equipment and the performance, and I have a lot more interested in recording than I actually have stuff to record. So that's my biggest problem. But the battery meter for people that really do have stuff to record is a serious thing, and I've thought about that a little bit. And there's obviously stuff that could be done in that area, that low-cost, no-cost solution. A beep or some method of inquiring the current status. It'd be great if it was proactive and just did something in your headphones when it got to a certain point. Or maybe, this is probably getting into a bit more cost, but just put a cell phone vibrator in the device and have the thing vibrate when it gets to a 10% battery level. Might get the job done. Then you could be totally headphones free.
That's a great idea, actually.
And I know those motors are, you know, got to be a penny a dozen, so.
Oh, yeah, they're cheap.
Yeah.
I suppose, like we said, it's not practical. It's not going to be an inexpensive consumer product for someone to come out with a device from the ground up that's totally accessible, maybe text-to-speech in the menus and so forth. But I wonder about the feasibility of going to Eddie Roll or M Audio and saying, look, can you put a little vibrator in here when the battery gets down to 10%? Can you, or even give us a little button to push to give us a gauge on the battery, maybe the higher the pitch, the higher the battery level or something like that. All these things we talked about, it can't be that much to add that to something like that.
Right. The difficulty is getting the enthusiasm to the person that be in charge of making the decision.
Well, and I think one strategy for that, too, would be to show them how that could benefit more than just blind people.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there's other disabilities that are having trouble with different, devices as well.
Well, and even mainstream users, how don't you think it would be useful that someone recording in maybe a dark situation, or they need to be using their eyes for something else, would be, it'd be useful for them to have a clip indicator or a battery low indicator that didn't depend purely on a visual cue?
It would seem that way. In fact, the clip indicator in Studio Recorder was not only designed as a tone in the headphones for disability considerations, but it turns out that that's the best way to let the narrators in the studio know that they've clipped.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't have time to be looking over at a display or even the monitor. I mean, they're following the copy. They don't. They're not watching meters and looking at numbers the whole time. So our audible clip indicator was inspired sort of by both needs there.
Another problem with accessibility on these recorders is when you pause them, and you may forget, am I paused or am I recording? Now, I will say the Olympus does a great job in that area. If you have the beeps turned on in the menus, you get two beeps for a pause. You press the record key again, you get your one beep to let you know you're recording. So at least you know what you're doing.
That's great. And I have a... Some of the old Sony CD players, though this is not nearly as useful, for whatever reason, they beeped while they were in pause. They beep about every second.
Oh, really?
I guess to let you know that we're running down your battery.
Okay.
But they had, interestingly enough, in the manual, like a secret key sequence, you could do something to make that beep go away if you didn't want any beeps.
Hmm.
So companies have gotten close to this. They've kind of nudged up to the issue indirectly, but... I guess we're just not a large enough clientele at the moment to really get this on the front burner or even on the back burner. And I guess I'm not a very patient person. I spent quite a bit of time with the MicroTrack menus this weekend, and it's very frustrating when you change an option that you don't know you've changed. You think you've changed one, but you've changed another one. You don't find out till a while down the road that you changed to MP3 mode, for example, rather than changed from mic to line in. And then you got to get it back. And without a simple way to restore defaults on these devices, that you're just going to spend more time getting it back and counting menu items. I think one of the other troubles on the MicroTrack that I seem to be having is it's very easy to change the menu selection just by the slightest tap of that that stick that they actually call a wheel, but it's more like an up down in type stick device. And I probably got into the wrong menu a couple times without realizing it, just because I bumped it or you know didn't push it straight in. I think that's one of the problems on the iRiver IFP899.
Yeah,
it's their joystick is structured in such a way that it's very easy to press down when you press in,
or to either side or up. Yeah. It's hard to tell.
Now, Nokia got that right on the cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
It must be a different spring switch or whatever, but I don't recall ever pressing in and getting an up down or a left right.
What are some of the other things as we've looked at these digital recorders that aren't necessarily accessibility issues, but recorder issues that would seem to benefit the most amount of people, whether they're blind or not? I know one of the things we had talked about with the M-Audio unit was that tendency to have that low-frequency rumble that it was picking up.
Well, this is real interesting. We need to do some more tests with this, but we sent Larry around the building with the MicroTrack and the binaurals, and it seemed like on every other footstep, we'd get a clip, full-scale clip.
We could insert a little clip of that here, in fact.
Okay.
So this is a sample of the M-Audio M-Tracks. Just doing my normal walking. I have the unit in my pocket.
It's low-frequency rumble, energy generated from jarring the microphone elements as you walk along. And the advantage to some of these cheaper recorders is that gets filtered out. It might just be a natural result of the design, or it may have been intentional, but if you do this kind of work and you're lucky enough to have a recorder that filters this out, you're good to go. In the case of the MicroTrack, even at the mic input, it appears that the frequency response in the lower frequencies is pretty much flat. It's down about a half a dB at 10 hertz, for example. So you're going to get all kinds of unwanted junk down in those low frequencies. It's almost like a whole other, thing is going on in your recording, like a subculture is laying in the bottom of your recording there. And you really don't want that stuff. And once it gets to the digital stage, it's too late. So there are solutions. I mean, you can buy a mic preamp that has roll-off switches and carry that around with you, but then you have one more component to haul around and have set right and to put batteries in and to make sure its connectors stay clean and you don't crack one of the cables and everything that goes with having another component.
When would you ever want to record anything that low?
There are very few situations. I've seen mixers usually tend to have like maybe a 70, 75 hertz roll-off switch on them. And to me, that's a little high. I would be happy if something would pretty much filter hard around 30. But you do have to sort of roll into it. You can't just necessarily have an instant shelving effect. But to answer the question, maybe a thunderstorm, maybe a pipe organ. Pipe organs, I believe, get down to 16 hertz. Perhaps an earthquake. But outside of those events, a fireworks display. maybe. Although I'd imagine it'd be really hard to record without clipping in a really high SPL situation like a fireworks display. I'm sure there's equipment that'll do it, but it's probably not a couple hundred hours.
SPL being?
Sound pressure level. It's the decibel level of a given sound. I don't know what the sound pressure level of a typical fireworks display is, but I would imagine if you can feel it in your chest, it's pretty high. And we all know that one of the most exciting things about a fireworks display is feeling it in your chest.
Right. You were telling me an interesting story earlier about testing some of these low frequencies with your speakers. And, you know, we can't hear below, what, 20 hertz?
Yeah, the typical human hearing range is supposed to be 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. I suspect there's very few people around that can actually hear 20 to 20. There may be, and if you're one of us, if you're one of them, let us know on the comment line. The difficulty with low frequencies is A, you may or may not be able to hear them, and B, your equipment may or may not be able to reproduce them. So you got to get these two things working together before you can really experience low frequencies, you know, in the 20 hertz range and lower. I think with most subwoofers these days, I don't really know, but I'm guessing that most people are probably adequately set up to reach 30 hertz easily with a decent subwoofer. So let's assume that the 30 hertz is a good workable bass frequency. If you want to get down lower than that, you need, you know, a larger driver, a larger enclosure, more power, something that is recorded that low, and the ability to hear it. You can certainly feel it, that's for sure. I had done an experiment probably, 10, 15 years ago, where I had a very low frequency signal. I think it was about 16 hertz. And I wanted to see if it was being played back. I was pretty sure I wasn't hearing it, but I couldn't really determine if I was actually moving the air or not. I cranked this thing up and went into the kitchen in my house, in my apartment, and I couldn't hear anything, but I did notice that the window was rattling back and forth. So apparently I was, in fact, sending a 16 hertz signal through my apartment.
So this window was rattling at 16 times per second.
I might, and briefly, while we're on the topic, the difficulty with high frequencies isn't so much your equipment's ability to reproduce them, because most tweeters these days are easily going to do 20,000 hertz. In fact, most any tweeter wouldn't have much trouble with that. The difficulty would be hearing them. And, I think most people hear between 15 and 18,000 hertz, maybe as a max. If you can turn on your FM radio and crank it up and hear a high whistle that hurts your head, that's 19,000 hertz.
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah. Before we leave this topic, let me advise that it's not really wise to crank up your equipment and play loud test tones at the frequency extremes. Do it, if you get into this kind of thing, do it with caution, because it's not really good for the ears and it's not really good for the equipment. So, know what you're doing. Keep the levels down low. Certainly okay to run test tone sweeps to see how a particular component performs, but be careful, because you can easily fry your tweeters and not know it. You can put a lot of strain on your woofers or your ears, depending on the frequency. So tread lightly.
When you talk about feeling low frequencies, I'm assuming you're meaning feeling it in your chest, but I remember one time riding in a car with a young person that had one of these bone-rattling stereos in their car.
Right.
And I think I could feel it in my ears. I mean, it actually tickled the insides of my ears with the bass.
That sounds like something to be avoided.
Yeah, I would. Definitely.
I'm not sure if I can relate to that, but I have thought somebody was going to collapse my kidneys a time or two with bass in the back of a seat. And we are a bass culture. Something happened. I guess the science of acoustics and the science of electronics all came together at one point in the 80s or so, and I said, we can build a speaker that puts out this much SPL at this low frequency. People just ate that stuff up. I mean, we are bass hounds. So somebody should set up a website, basshound.com, if they haven't already.
It may be there.
Because there's people can't get enough, as you hear when they drive down the street.
Well, and I wonder what's the appeal of having your trunk lid rattle with each bass
beat.
Isn't
that hideous?
Maybe you don't hear it inside the car.
Yeah, well, definitely not. That must be part of it. But it doesn't sound too impressive from the outside.
It does.
But when you figure, if you can hear low-frequency energy, probably in the range of 30 to 40 hertz, a block away, that's way, way too much SPL in that car.
And that's got to be hurting somebody's hearing and ears.
Yeah, that can't be a good thing. And it's also a serious disturbance at that point. I mean, you've gone beyond a reasonable use of equipment.
Well, I know that was a very uncomfortable feeling for me when it was tickling the insides of my ears like that. Very uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah.
Anything else you want to say about the M-Audio unit in general terms of that? I mean, we had that excellent review from Neil Ewers. One thing I wanted to mention about it, I love the size of it. It feels cheap, though.
It does have a kind of a cheap feel to it, and I don't know that I'd be dropping either one, but my bets would be on the R1, the Eddie Roll, if I had to pick who would come out of a fight. It does have some exposed switches that may be damaged in a drop. But the R1 feels to me just a slight bit better construction. It seems a bit more durable, a little heavier. The MicroTrack performs reasonably well. Somebody had mentioned on the Blind Cool Tech list that the solution for these noisy preamps in these two devices, and I will say that I think they're about equally noisy. They're within a couple dB of each other. The solution would be to just buy a really hot mic. Not so with the R1, though, because the R1 mic preamp overloads quite easily as well, where the MicroTrack doesn't. It seems to be able to take a pretty high signal level. So if you're going to be doing loud events and your mics can handle it and you definitely have a pure signal going in, the MicroTrack preamp's going to be the one to use there. I don't know. They're so different. That's why this is such an exciting time in the compact flash recorder. We have true competition. The R1 is so much larger.
Yeah, that's a real drawback.
Though the MicroTrack is maybe a little bit thicker than the R1. And if I had my choice, I'd prefer just a little thinner and maybe a little wider on the MicroTrack. It's, it doesn't bother you too much in the pocket, but it's definitely thick. Especially up at the display. I think that's the thickest part, according to the manual.
Well, one thing, too, about the size and configuration of the R1 is, for some stupid reason, the microphone jack is actually on the side of the unit, which makes it very inconvenient to carry it in your pocket.
That's a good point. In the case of the MicroTrack, the headphone jack and mic jack are both on the top, so you can stick it in your pocket and have your cables come out. No need for a right-angle adapter in most cases. R1, the headphone jack's on the top. It's great, but mic jack and line-in jack are both on the side. And the line-in jacks on the MicroTrack are on the bottom. Perhaps that would be worse. I don't think anybody would try to put the MicroTrack in their pocket with quarter-inch plugs going into it. Maybe they would. But it would be fairly inconvenient to do so.
One thing I wanted to mention a while ago, we were talking about accessible line level controls. And I must say, the Plexstor PTR1 has got one of the most ingenious level control indicators that I've seen.
It does. And, of course, that's a very market-specific device.
And it's a $1,000 device, too.
But they got the level setting right. I don't know. Actually, I don't really know the PTR1 well. It didn't speak to me, and maybe I should spend more time with it at some point. I'm not sure why it didn't speak to me, except maybe for the fact that it was $1,000 and it was kind of large.
And it doesn't have stereo microphone.
I didn't know that back then, though. And it also it uses CDs. I don't know if you can record directly to compact flash.
I believe you can. Yeah.
And it was almost there. We got that, and I thought, man, that would be something I'd be interested in if I just had the time. Now with the R1 and the MicroTrack, it was love at first touch. Those things definitely speak to me, and I'm sure they speak to a lot of you guys out there. That's why we're doing these podcasts on these. And I'm sure, and we hope that other products will come along that meet needs, maybe in slightly different ways, maybe in more accessible ways, maybe in performance, build quality. Back on the MicroTrack briefly, I see one of the big drawbacks is the non-removable, non-replaceable, rechargeable battery.
Yeah.
Neil brought up the interesting question in his review. How much is it? Well, it's $75 to have the battery replaced on the MicroTrack. I don't know how long they're going to last. I should get the word out here. We didn't know this when we got ours. But the manual claims that if you don't fully charge it the first time, you may limit the life of your battery. So if you do get a MicroTrack, be sure to charge it until A, you've had somebody verify that it says it's charged, or B, it's been at least 6.5 hours, I believe they recommend in the manual. But obviously, for people doing a lot of serious field recordings, you can't have a device that goes down and you can't get it going again. I'm sure there's probably ways to do it. Somebody's probably made a battery-powered USB power supply or some such thing, but that's just inconvenient. And
it really is.
I think that in the case of the MicroTrack, I think I would have been willing to pay a little more for replaceable batteries. And even at the cost of little size. And I can't recall the other things about it that I would like to see a little better. Maybe quieter mic preamps on the 1/8-inch input, that definitely would be an advantage. Although there's ways to get around that. I guess there's ways to get around all these limitations if you feel like putting the time, the money, and carrying around more stuff. Certainly the R1 has its limitations as well with going through batteries left and right. Now, of course, you can carry plenty of batteries on you. And I should mention here, too, that we use some name brand alkalines, and we did get better performance on the R1. I recorded a meeting, I don't know, was it an hour and a half?
Mm-hmm.
We got through the hour and a half meeting this time with no battery problems, and we were able to use those batteries for various playback and recording minor things for a couple days later. So,
That brings up a good point. What is the acceptable time that one should be able to record in the ideal recorder? I rant and rave about how disappointed I am about the WS-200S, and now the 300s are coming out where you get lots of recording time, but the quality is just not up there. The DS-2 has got the quality, but you only get 1 hour of recording at that quality. The Eddie Roll is a similar situation. You've got the quality, but your batteries are limiting you there. Is 4 hours enough? Is eight? Obviously, we'd rather have eight.
It depends on your venue.
True.
If you want to record concerts, 2.5 hours might be enough. I would take the Eddie Roll and a fresh set of batteries, record it in Wave, you're good to go. that you're good to go as long as you have, you know, the appropriately sized flash car, of course. If you want to do podcasting, maybe, you know, maybe a week, like of the kind of work you do, might be appropriate for, or at least a couple days. You want to be able to turn that thing on and depend on it that I'm going to be able to get through Wednesday afternoon with this, or I'm going to be able to get to this whole week, and then this weekend I can sit down and take all this stuff off of here. I'm not going to worry about losing the stuff. It's going to be there when I need it. If something comes up, I've got enough memory, I have enough power to get through an unexpected meeting or whatever I need. I guess it really depends on how you use it. I don't recall the record times for the MicroTrack. A couple hours, I believe, maybe three. It's different with Phantom Power.
Yeah.
So it depends on the microphones you're using and how you're using it. And of course, I don't have a clue how much I get out of any of these devices. Because I don't think most people sit down with a device and set their stopwatch.
That's true.
Because you're using, they draw different amounts of current depending on how you're using them. So just because it's on doesn't necessarily mean you're going to put the load on it. Even if you do turn it on and just say, I'm going to record and use a stopwatch, you know, the performance is going to vary slightly depending on the flash card you use and the kind of batteries you're using at the time.
Probably how you're encoding it too, possibly, huh?
I suspect so, because the encoder may take more current, but then you're using less flash card current. But then if you're writing to the disk in wave mode and not using the encoder, then you're using more flash card than you're using encoder. So, you know, it's a balancing act, and I think a technician that builds one of these things would probably speak to that, unfortunately, better than we can, but there's definitely, you know, those kind of things to consider.
Well, it's pretty clear, I guess, in conclusion, that the days of the cassette tape are very, very numbered. I mean, personally, I haven't used a cassette tape in years, literally.
Do they still sell them? I really haven't looked.
I hadn't either.
I guess they do. And I wonder, I'm glad to see the cassette go.
I am too. But we need something that we can depend on to record with as well.
And we're using these recorders in such a different way than a person used a cassette recorder. When you made a cassette recording, it was probably going to forever be a first generation master, essentially, where you would use that cassette tape as a storage medium. Now, these recorders are kind of like a camera where it's all you need is temporary storage just to get the thing done and then get it back to your PC and get it off there. That's why, in my case, size and the ability to, you know, archive from the device aren't really such a big deal. In other words, you're not going to go out and buy 50 flashcards and stick them in a box with your cassettes. That's one of the differences, I think, that we've seen discussed lately is that the question becomes, do these flash recorders replace mini disc recorders? And I personally think that mini disc's days on Earth are numbered. And I never really did. I thought mini disc was very interesting, but I never, wholesale bought into the technology. But I know a lot of people have, and the one advantage mini discs have is that the media is relatively inexpensive and you can store 50, 100, 200 of those things in a relatively small space and get them out, and hopefully they'll play in 5 years. Now, that's the other question. Is anything we record today available 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now? With cassettes, the answer is yes. We know for a fact that cassettes recorded in the 70s still play.
As long as they hadn't degraded physically.
Right. And we also know that there's a good chance they didn't. If you bought reasonably good cassettes back in the cassette heyday, I'll bet you can still play them, if you can find something to play them on.
That's a good point.
That wasn't the case with reel-to-reel, because in the reel-to-reel realm, we had the case of the cheap tape that had that squeaky stick problem where the chemicals got pasty and they would squeak on your heads when they played, and you had to put them in the oven to play them back once or twice and make a copy. Thankfully, cassettes don't have that problem. They got the formula right. But, is something recorded on a micro track today going to be available when you need it 20 years from now? Is it going to be on a CD where the table of contents got ruined and you can't read the CD because that's sort of the key part? Is it going to be a particular part of the recording got damaged on the CD, or is it just going to be that the chemicals on the CD didn't withstand the test of time? And these are some of the things you have to think about when you switch to a different medium.
Well, you know, it's not just the media, too. It's the actual file format. Who's to say that WAV is going to be available in 20 years? I'm sure there'll be conversion utilities.
Let me say that we will probably be able to play back PCM data, which is essentially uncompressed WAV, for many, 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 many years to come. MP3, on the other hand, because it's a customized format and very, very specific, very technical, very complex, it may be hard to come across an MP3 decoder in 20 years. I don't know. That's a valid question. It could be that there's other digital technologies besides PCM, which is very simple, that may emerge that would make it difficult to play back PCM, although I still think it'll be around for a long time. CD players play basically PCM, 16-bit 44.1. And CDs are going to be around for a long time. But that's another consideration. Is your archival medium and your format appropriate if you care about the future? If you care about getting it up in a podcast for tomorrow, that's fine. I mean, obviously that works. I know a guy that we had this debate many years ago over lunch. I would say, you know, what's the best quality CDR you can buy for a reasonable price? And he said, I don't care because I'm going to use them. I'm going to throw them away in a week. He would just burn them, play them in his car, and when he got tired of them, he didn't care if he lost them or threw them away. I was more interested in, well, what are we going to, you know, put our backups on here at APH? What do we want to put our software on, our recordings from the studio, and know that we can get at these 5 or 10 years from now, or 15 years from now? And I don't have these answers. I haven't really studied CDR technology. I have heard that they can degrade and become useless over time, but I don't know which company, which chemical formulas, you know, all the ins and outs of that.
All good things to consider and think about. In concluding, we'd sure like to get some feedback from you about what we can do as consumers to interest the mainstream companies in at least giving us some some piece of accessibility to these units. Recording is a very important thing for us. We need to be able to use these units. So
microwaves are important. Ovens, dryers, washers, anything that you buy that you can't use is equally important, I think.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, we just happen to be on the topic of recorders, and we'd love for those to all be accessible. But, you go out today and buy pretty much any stereo receiver. It's going to be at least 5.1 channels. It's going to have likely at least one menu to set up different configuration options. You're probably not going to get through that alone. In fact, you're probably not going to get through it with someone you get to help you because they may not understand it.
That's always a problem.
It's a very frustrating experience.
It really is. I don't know if you got to see it this year, Rob. The NFB convention was here in Louisville, of course, and one of the things there was the Accessible Appliances Showcase. Very interesting to go in there and look at washers and dryers that have not necessarily controls that were designed for a blind person, but that were usable. They were audible, tactually discriminable. There's actually a podcast on Blind Cool Tech about that back from July, if you want to check that out.
That sounds great. And there is progress being made in some of these areas.
Some of it actually happens to be just happenstance, unfortunately. But.
Right. But if I was faced today with buying a dryer, for example, I'd prefer to have one with a good old analog timer, you know, where they've been making them that way since the 60s or whatever, maybe earlier. You know, I mean, it might be nice to have the modern thing and some of the features that come along with that. But, you know, you just get... We have a dishwasher that's basically all touch controls. Well, thankfully, though, you can feel them. They are buttons.
Yeah. And that's not to be said for all of them.
Right. But you still have to find out what they are and try to memorize them.
Yeah.
And that's one of the problems I have, I think, with these recorders. I can memorize the features I might use every day, but the memory isn't what it used to be. And if you're going to memorize all the menus in your recorder, you're going to put a lot of energy into doing that and then getting it right when the time comes. And if you're in a stressful situation and you got a once-in-a-lifetime recording and you don't know what mode you're in, hopefully you make the right decision.
Well, and, you know, that's part of the drawback of a more complex society. You know, I think we could all pretty well figure out that our tape recorder was actually recording back in the day, as they say now.
Right.
It's not the case with these digital recorders.
Sure isn't.
This weekend, just happened to pick up, we'd been looking for a waffle iron, and saw one at Sam's that had a huge analog on-off switch and analog dial for the heat, and get this, an audio indicator, a beep, when the iron heated up, ready for the first waffle and for each waffle that you made.
How about that?
That is progress.
See that?
Waring, W-A-R-I-N-G is the company. Great waffle maker, by the way.
I don't recommend you wear it.
Not very good for recording either. Okay, anything you'd like to conclude with, Ron?
We're good. We've probably
beat this dead horse.
This has been a long one. You're still with us.
Yeah, we even put Jake to sleep twice.
Right.
If you have comments about, you know, what we can do as blind people to encourage these manufacturers, or maybe let's look down the road of somebody creating a totally accessible recorder from the ground up, do give us a call on our comment line. We'll play that on the air. The number is 984. Oh, no, it's not. It's 206-984-9203. You can email us at blindcooltech@gmail.com or check us out on the web at blindcooltech.com. Thanks for joining us, Rob.
All right.